the Science Witch podcast, where we explore how science and witchcraft intersect, interact, and affirm one another. I'm your co-host, Ruby.
And I'm your co-host, Angel.
And I'm your co-host, James. And this is our 67th episode, and an interview with stand-up comic and aspiring screenwriter, Rick Charisma, who is also Angel's partner.
Yeah, so we've been together now for almost 6 months, so I'm allowed to bring him on to the podcast since, you know, it's lasted past that three-month limit that we designated from a few other attempts at this. Rick is quickly becoming such a huge part of my life, and I'm really excited to share both his humor and talent with the listeners on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. I also got to stay with him while I was in Salem while we were in the lead-up to the Trans Telethon. Genuinely, like, this recording that we're about to, like, hear this episode, this was my first time speaking with him ever. And honestly, I felt pretty nervous going into it. I had a lot of, like, preconceived notions about comedy and comedians that y'all just, like, broke me the fuck out of. And especially over that night when you took me to the comedy night at the Infinity Room, that was a good time.
Oh yes, that was such a good time.
But yeah, I did get to see him, or like a few of his shorts that he puts on TikTok beforehand, but like still, the jokes that someone tells, it can only tell you so much as to the how like a person is until you meet him face to face. And staying with him for a week was truly a privilege, and we got to swap a lot of like music and ideas and a lot of bullshits, and smoked a lot of weed, and it was just so nice to get to make a new friend, and I'm glad to introduce you guys to him.
Yeah, and it's always good to talk to creative people and hear about how they go about practicing their craft, and as well as their experiences. You know, comedy is such an important part of culture, and it really is a powerful way to shape how we understand both like complex issues and ourselves. I published what will be the first episode in a new Patreon mostly series that I have dubbed Tripping Through the Tarot, and the first episode is of course on the first card in the Major Arcana, the Fool. And in this episode, I talk about my experiences first meeting Rick and getting to know the stand-up comedy community in our town. And one of the things I really appreciate about Rick, or Mio as I call him, is how thoughtful and intuitive he is about considering the impacts of different approaches to comedy, both on himself, the people he talks about, and also on the audiences.
Yeah, I really appreciated what Rick said about getting consent before putting people from his personal life, like you, Angel, into his comedy writing. I think there's a really old school style of comedy where especially cishet men joke about their girlfriends or their wives in a way that's like, do you really, really even like this person? Like that kind of, oh, the old ball and chain, you know, outdated kind of comedy is really uncomfortable and unfunny to me.
Agreed.
But another thing that stuck out to me, Angel, was when you talked about when comedy just becomes trauma dumping. But then you said one of your favorite comedians was Hannah Gadsby. So, you know, if we've seen her comedy, I was kind of wondering, where do you draw the line?
You know, I actually talk about this a little bit in that episode of Tripping Through the Tarot that I posted on the main feed, where there's just like this widely varying spectrum of what I consider funny when it comes to comics, basically just dumping their trauma onto the audience. And I can't really say specifically what it is that makes something funny versus cringe, but I know it when I see it. And so, for instance, one of our fellow friends in the comic scene, she's been doing a lot of bits about growing up in a household where her father was a violent narcissist and all of her family were gambling addicts. And somehow, the way that she does it and delivers it, it's really funny. You just like laugh with her, and in that, I think it's healing. But then there's other comics that when they talk about sort of one guy, he likes to talk about how he's helped three of his friends talk down from suicide and how he wants to try to find the one that's going to do it. And it's just like, this isn't funny or even kind. And I don't know how to delineate what is just unfunny and not in any way worth continuing to make jokes about versus what really is something that can make that human connection through comedy.
I think the key word you said there was healing. Yes. If it's not healing, then it's not doing the right
thing. Yeah.
Just as far as, for me, music goes, some of the best music out there explicitly is trauma dumping, and some of it is also funny as shit. That being said, like, there's a time and place. There's a time and place for it, and there's ways to say it. Some comedy routines just truly just age better than others, in that it's very much a reflection of the times that we live in and the times that we lived in. And if we're gonna try to be funny, it's up to us in how we approach that kind of media literacy. If you want that shit to age well.
Mm-hmm.
And largely we did talk about knowing your audience and how knowing your audience can make or break your comedy career if that's something you're aiming for. But without further ado, let's introduce the audience, and through wibbly wobbly timey wimey shenanigans, myself to Rick Charisma.
Well, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Science Witch podcast. Today we have a special guest, which I say as about the fact that the special guest this time is also my partner, and we had to wait at least 3 months before we could bring you on the show because that's a rule for me. But yeah, today we're going to be talking about comedy, the role of comedy, as well as speaking truth to power with my partner, Rick Charisma. So Rick, why don't you start out by introducing yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about you and your work.
My name is Rick Charisma. I've written at least the first draft of 15 different screenplays. I lived in LA from 2010 to 2011, and I tried doing stand-up there to no luck. My material started getting a little too self-deprecating, and it was kind of fucking with my mental health, so I thought it would be best to stop. And then earlier this year, I started trying it out again, and I'm having a pretty good time. That's about me in comedy.
Yeah, and as you said before, you are also a comedy writer, and you've written up to 15 screenplays now?
Yes, correct. Finished at least the first draft of them, so...
What are some themes you like to explore?
I like writing about various things. I just like coming up with weird stories that I have not seen yet. I wrote one about a rock band that the lead singer, this is gonna be some spoilers for future generations when they can see this movie, but the singer eventually starts to think that he's Jesus Christ, and yeah, that's one of them.
Is that more of a comedy or a psychological thriller or, I don't know, a sci-fi? Does he get Jesus robots?
Oh, it's definitely just a dark comedy. I have a very twisted sense of humor.
So you mentioned down in LA your comedy was fairly self-deprecating. Is that something that's shifted while you're performing in different places? Or, yeah, what do you think of the role of that kind of self-critique or self-deprecation and humor?
I think self-deprecation is fine. I just think that too much of it could I mean, for me anyways, it like really started messing with my mental health. And it got to a point where it was kind of like, I don't think I should be doing this anymore. And when I started doing it again this year, I did have some self-deprecating things when I started out. I mean, nothing too bad. But then I met Bruisha here, Angel, and they kind of were like very anti comedians just doing self-deprecating stuff. And I've taken that into account. And I have not really written anything too self-deprecating since. Every now and then I'll sprinkle in something that's a little, that pokes fun at me a little bit, but I've been trying to avoid it.
Well, there's a difference between being self-deprecating and being honest.
Yes.
And you can still be funny while being honest.
Agreed.
About yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But I feel like there's this tendency of some of the stand-ups in that I've seen. Obviously, now, since you and I've been dating, I've seen a lot of stand-up comedy. And I just feel bad about some of the things they say about themselves on stage. And it's one of those things where, like, one of my favorite stand-up comedians is this lesbian woman from Tasmania, Hannah Gatsby, and she has really taken a stance against comics just going up and shitting on themselves constantly. Like, in her opinion, it's like time to like move beyond just shitting on yourself as a way to, I guess, in some ways, get laughs, but at the expense of your own self-worth at times. And in, you know, in yoga, there's a concept called ahimsa, which means no harm. And I know that comedy in some ways has to be at times self-depreciating, or at least that's the way it seems. But like some comics, that's the only thing they know is how to like basically shit on themselves for laughs. And that's something that I really want to challenge, and I really want people to think about. It's like, is that the only way to get laughs? Is that the only way to have comedy, is to be self-depreciating? And so, now that Rick and I are dating, I've been like, well, if you're going to be self-depreciating, it has to have a really good reason.
Or it better be really funny.
Similar to that thread, I kind of have this belief that, like, not all humor should rely on pain.
No, not at all.
Like, as a concept.
No.
Like, that's one thing that, like, I'm from Montana, and there's a lot of right-wingers here, even in this, or in Blue City, sorry. Conversations with people who consider themselves, like, liberals and leftists, and still say just, like, oh, like, all comedy is based off of the, like, suffering of other people. And I'm like, dude, no. A lot of it's just built off of irony. Like, that doesn't necessarily have to come at the expense of another person.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that there's also, I've seen a tendency of some comics to basically trauma dump on the audience. And, you know, I wanted to kind of maybe even talk about it, that it's there's this almost like catharsis of standing up there on that stage and saying the quiet part out loud. And in some ways this can be really funny, and in other ways it people will laugh, but it's sort of that nervous laugh because you're in an environment in which you're sort of like socially obligated to laugh whether or not it's funny. And I've seen, like, comics confess things about their life in ways that I have to be trauma dumped on and I didn't consent to. And I feel like there's almost this sort of tacit acceptance that that's what comedy is. And I don't know, like, maybe I'm too much of a bleeding heart liberal, but I want comedy to be kinder. And, what are your thoughts, Rick, on that topic?
No, I completely agree that about how you want comedy to be kinder, because that's something that I have actually like really started exploring since I started, even since before I met you, where I was like writing just really silly jokes about like Muppets and cartoon characters that really aren't hurting anybody. It's just silly, and I think that it's funny, and it's not hurting anybody.
But what do you think it is about the, I don't know, like just speaking about your trauma on in a way and turning it into comedy? What do you like? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that it can be done. I don't think that it's always going to work and it's always going to be funny. But I honestly think that every single subject can be made funny, as long as it really depends on who the person is that's telling the joke. Not everyone can tell every joke. But I've heard some really, really fucked up things that were hilarious because of who was telling the joke. And if that joke had been told by, like, some random white dude, it's like, no, my guy, that's not for you.
There is a segment currently kind of poking fun at this idea on Seth Meyers' show. He has an entire Jokes Seth Can't Say segment where he has someone with a different social location to come out and basically poke fun at their own community.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But obviously,
yeah,
he's not a social location to do that.
Right, yeah. They kind of do the same thing on SNL, on Weekend Update, where Michael Che will write jokes for Colin Jost, and Colin Jost will write jokes for Michael Che. And it's always very uncomfortable, but in kind of the right way.
And it's self-referentially uncomfortable. It's like the bit, and it's sort of expected.
Right.
And so I think it's... And with SNL, I think one of the things that's really different about that is it's a team of writers and people with lots of different perspectives.
Right.
Regardless of like who is the mouthpiece, or like the actor on the show, or like serving as an actor in that moment, it's a little bit less, for me anyway, it feels a little bit less intense than some of the sort of like quote unquote edgy stand-up that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And definitely, I mean, even going back to, you know, Ruby's comment, you know, I feel like a lot of millennial and younger comedians are already moving away from that sort of like self-hate or hate of other paradigm of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I could just think of like Mae Martin or sort of any host of younger people, Julio Torres, like they're not doing mean humor. They're just doing, I mean, maybe Mae Martin's a little self-deprecating, but like in a really light and sort of like reveling in their weirdness, you know, more than putting themselves down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kind of brings up one of the questions we wanted to talk about, and is that, do you think that comedy has a responsibility to be socially conscious?
I think that everyone should be able to read the room, whether that means the people who are in the room with you, like, literally, or social climate. Yeah, that's kind of just everything I said right now is really all I wrote for that.
But, I mean, as far as, like, what I mean by political correctness, do you think that there's anything that's, like, off limits for comedy?
I think that there are limitations for whoever is trying to be funny. But I think that every topic can be potentially funny, depending on who is trying to be funny. Does that make sense to everyone?
If I understand correctly, if I may translate this to kind of music, because you see a lot of examples of... Let's take the song Africa by Toto, for example. It was
Honkies.
Written largely by a group of gringos, but the main composed, wrote it because he had such a like deep love of African drumming and wanted to contribute in a respectful manner, and the result was Africa. And that guy actually happens to be John Williams' son. A fantastic example of adding your voice to a conversation with a style that, you know, he from a culture he is not a part of, but is still respectful to that conversation. Like, there are ways to do
things
respectfully, and that also pertains to comedy.
I feel like it's kind of important, though, to also sort of unpack even what we're talking about. We talk about being socially conscious or politically correct. Those are, especially political correctness, right? That's such a fraught term, and people use it in so many different ways. Yeah, like, what do we actually mean by political correct or socially conscious here?
What do we mean by political correctness?
Yeah, or I guess maybe either Angel, how were you understanding that idea? Or Rick, like, how were you hearing that? And yeah, like, how are we kind of operationalizing this force of political correctness?
Because I think it's sort of also about whether or not your comedy ages well. Because I think that's also sort of a component of what we mean by, like, political correctness. It's like, if somebody can listen to your comedy 30 years from now, where things have advanced, hopefully our society has progressed and not regressed, and they can still find it funny without, like, cringing about, like, how, I don't know, like, misogynistic or racist it was. Because you can see that in a lot of, like, some of the boomer comics that
refuse to adapt with the with the climate. That's one thing that really bothers me, is when you see comedians or people that used to be funny saying, oh, you can't be funny anymore because everyone's too politically correct. No, motherfucker, just adapt with the times. You can still be funny. You just have to be able to read the room. It's lazy to just be like, oh, you can't be funny anymore. Well, why don't you try?
Well, that in itself is such a trope right now, and it's almost like a cash grab. You know, every time that a larger name in comedy or one of the other arts, like, gets supposedly quote unquote canceled, it's really usually just like they're critiqued in some way, and then they jump on this idea that they've been canceled to make a shit ton of money and sell out venues and get specials on Netflix and get, you know, on talk shows. So it's such a weird, I feel like it's almost like a hoax. People at lower levels are getting, like, canceled and in extreme cases doxed and really shunned from society. But at the larger levels of the people who are loudly complaining about it in the media, I feel like it's almost a smart career choice that they're making, or a strategic career choice.
I feel like no big stars ever truly get canceled. They just, like, switch political parties. Like, Louis C.K.
Yeah.
Like, when everyone was like, we don't want anything to do with you anymore, he just became a Republican. And, like, Republicans are, like, the only ones who defend him now. And it's kind of like, did you not see this guy's comedy before? He does not like you.
Right.
It's
Although I feel like sometimes the same can be said for, like, Jeff Foxworthy and the Blue Collar Comedy Tour. It's like they're doing, like, offensive stereotypes of rednecks, and they've made very lucrative careers off of it, even though they are upper middle class white guys who have never spent time around. You know, people who grew up in trailer parks.
Didn't you tell me that Larry the Cable Guy, where did you say that he's from?
He's from Nebraska.
And where does he act like he's from?
Well, he acts like he's from the South.
Yeah, he's like,
definitely acts like he's from the South.
Yeah, I would have.
But yeah, he was also, like, he's doing a character, but it's, I feel like it's read as somehow a lot more authentic than it is.
Yeah. there is sort of this style of comedy where you take on this role as a character, and in some ways that means that you can, I don't know, be free to be more salacious, or it sort of like takes responsibility away from the things you say, so you can say whatever you want if you're playing a character. But then when you're actually up there speaking as yourself, as you know, with your name, it sort of like makes you a lot more responsible about what you say.
Mm-hmm.
In the comedic sense. So let's turn to a topic that it is the Science Witch podcast. So when we first met, you identified as agnostic and you grew up in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And has your aspiration and experiences that you've used in your comedy, has that influenced your spiritual affiliations?
No, not really.
Or some of the things you talk about in your comedy, one of the sort of topics you like to talk about is, I guess in some ways, the religious trauma that you've experienced growing up in the Catholic Church, and that's sort of become one of the things that you get a lot of material from. And I guess is your comedy in some ways helping you both like contextualize and I guess process some of the religious trauma?
You mean,
that
is it like a little cathartic?
Yeah.
I don't know about cathartic, but it's like a comedic version of going to confession. I get to go on stage and talk about how I did a bit about how when I would go to confession, a lot of what I would confess was just about masturbating. And yeah, going on stage and doing comedy is a little bit like going to confession, because I'm confessing a lot of masturbation and sexual stuff.
Okay, Rick, I think you're onto something. You know, one thing we've kind of been circling around is like, why are so many like conservative comedians so unfunny? And it's for the same reason you just said. And it's because people on the right wing either like genuinely have such fucked up beliefs that if they like said it in the form of a joke,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't come off as funny. It would just piss people off. The things that they try to make funny just aren't.
But obviously there's an audience for it. I mean, you know, this comes down to like how subjective do we mean around things like funny, you know, because someone's finding it enjoyable enough to spend a lot of money on it. There's definitely an audience for it out there, even if I personally don't enjoy it. Yeah. So yeah, Rick, what makes something funny?
If you laugh at it. I mean, something might be funny to you that it won't be funny to someone else. It's hard to, like, say what's funny. That's such a... It's such a broad question. Because when I go on stage, everything that I say, I think is very funny. But I also recognize that not everyone will. I recognize that some things that I say, absolutely no one might find funny. And honestly, to me, that almost makes a dumb joke even funnier when I'll go on stage and say it with complete conviction, like, this is funny to me, and no one laughs. It's kind of like, all right, well, yeah, that's kind of what I expected, and it's fine. I'll move on now.
I was recently watching a bit from, what are they called? Dropout, that sort of like comedy collective, and they had, in a game show-like format, they forced someone to go out and just say the worst jokes. Kind of like the ones that I imagine Ruby was thinking of with the right-wing comments, but just like, just really bad and just bomb in front of an audience. And what was it? Every time they bombed, they had to say something like, it's all love, it's all love. And then they would just say another horrible joke, and no one would laugh. It's just one of the more uncomfortable things I've seen in my life, honestly, to watch someone just bomb over and over and over again.
Yeah, there's some without saying any specifics, but there's some comics that we've seen that will repeat the same material over and over and over. And they'll bomb, like, 90% of the time. And I'm sorry, but what are you getting out of this? This seems like, isn't this hurting your feelings?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think, like, there's this humiliation kink some of these comics have where they just, they, for one...
Do you think they get off on...
yeah, I do, because...
On being humiliated?
There's something cathartic for them of standing up off stage and saying just some of the most uncomfortable and at times traumatic things that happen to them as jokes. And then even if nobody laughs, that's still valuable or somehow like a release for them. At least that's my reasoning for why some of these people do it. But one of the things I have noticed is a lot of comics, what they tend to do is they'll come up with a set and they'll just redo that set every time. And you are a lot, you're different, because you, I feel like you're a comedy writer that performs your own stuff. You're not so much just like a stand-up. You actually are always writing material, and I think that is in some ways like one of the reasons why you're able to come up with such funnier stuff, because you're always writing new stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
Oh, it's just gonna say, I feel like that's increasingly important with like YouTube and those types of platforms, because I've definitely had the experience of watching someone's show or special and being totally charmed. And then what can I do? I can just binge watch everything that's been put on the internet for the last 10 years and then see, oh, this thing that was totally charming, this person's been doing the exact same thing over and over again for 10 years. And then it's a little, I don't know, it takes something away from it.
Yeah. Have you guys seen Last Comic Standing? It was on NBC like years and years back.
I think I have, yeah.
But the guy who won... The guy who won the first season, his name was Dat Fan, and when he was on that show, he won, and I was kind of like blown away by his stuff. It was very funny, and he has been doing the exact same material since, and this has been well over, like probably close to 15 years at this point. And I feel like that's just such a miserable thing. Like, why would you do that to yourself? You just like... Is it that hard to, like, write new material?
It's the same for American Idol.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Like, when was the last time you, like, heard anything from season 6 winner Taylor Hicks?
The only thing I know of his is Weird Al did a parody of one of his songs called Do I Creep You Out. I could not tell you what the original song was called, but the Weird Al one is pretty great. That's my extension, the extent of what I know about. I even forgot his name already.
Taylor Hicks. Let's talk about your comedy influences and some of the things that you really draw inspiration from.
If I have to say what like my all-time favorite comedy is, I would say The Simpsons from season 4 through season 10 and the first 3 seasons of Futurama. To me, that is comedy at its finest. I could just watch those anytime, and I might not like laugh out loud every time, but I'll always be like, oh, that's a good fucking joke. That joke is really fucking good. And I think that if you read a lot of my stuff, you'll be like, oh, that was definitely inspired by The Simpsons and Futurama.
That's not fair. You changed the outcome by measuring it.
Yeah, I also feel like there's this timelessness and universality about the humor in both The Simpsons and the Futurama that it, in some ways, like, creates the culture that then is, like, we watch it and then it creates reality. Because The Simpsons has been on for, what, 30 years now?
It's their 35th or 36th season is going to start.
And there's certain times...
35th, 1989.
Yeah. And there's certain times where The Simpsons has literally predicted the future.
Yeah, it's... You know what? The Simpsons predicted that Trump was going to die this year. And I don't want to get into the assassination attempt thing, but there's, like, people who have, like, all these, like, crazy theories about, like, oh, he was supposed to die when during the assassination attempt. The Simpsons predicted it, but now there's a whole new timeline. No, you guys are just crazy. The Simpsons just gets lucky in its predictions. There's no psychics that write for The Simpsons. They just get lucky because they kind of understand, the writers understand, like, American culture and the kind of shit that we do.
And there's just so much of it since it has been on for so many seasons. It's, you know, it's a huge data set there to mine for things that look like that.
And like, to a degree, I wonder if there's also a degree of autistic pattern recognition going on.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of the writing, not exact predicting the future in psychic terms, but in terms of, oh, this is something that I would think is could plausibly happen, even though it sounds stupid, and then it does.
Yeah. That is American culture.
So what is it about seasons 4 and 10 that draw you in so fully to have those stand out?
It really just feels like on season 4 they found their stride of what they wanted the show to be. And by season 10 it was kind of like they've done everything great. And it's just, what else do we do from here? And I mean, it's still good. There's still good episodes. But it's just not of that quality and that storytelling. Like, they started getting a lot of guest stars, and it was just very outlandish plot lines where, like, Homer was working with Mel Gibson. No, that's not believable. That's who wrote this? They used to have, like, everyday problems, and then Homer's meeting Mel Gibson and making a movie with him. That's no.
I wonder if Mel Gibson paid to be on The Simpsons. I think Elon Musk did some shenanigans like that, where he, like, somehow was able to cajole them into having Lisa talk about him as a genius or something. Or I've heard of.
Oh yeah, he definitely paid for that.
I haven't seen or heard that, but it would not surprise me.
Yeah. So in your comedy, you talk a lot about politics, especially this year, since we are in an election year.
Yeah, I was not talking any politics, and then, oh, there was that Eric Trump joke that I made. But after the assassination attempt, I was like, no, I need to be talking about the ridiculousness of everything going on.
And comedy has long been a way to rather speak truth to power. As far back as you have, like, the medieval court gestures, where we were the only ones who could be honest with the king, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the role of comedy in speaking truth to power? And as a comic, how do you incorporate that responsibility into what you do?
Well, my favorite way of getting the news is from, like, late-night comics, like Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and John Oliver, because they're informing you of what's going on by being really funny. And this actually might be why Republicans are brainwashed, because there's no, like, really funny Republican comedians to talk about what's going on and giving them actual information that isn't just bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that
there's no comedy that inspires critical thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you think of, like, any late night Republican comedians that actually talk about what's going on and are funny? It doesn't exist.
Well, I think in some ways you can't have a personality like that
because they're all their talking points are bullshit.
Yeah, they're not speaking any truth to power.
Right.
I could see Seinfeld maybe trying to get that gig, though. If they were willing to pay him, I'm sure Seinfeld would try for it.
No, you know who would do it is Tim Allen.
Oh, Tim Allen.
I actually saw an article a while back about how Tim Allen and the creator of Home Improvement were working on a new comedy show that was being described as anti-woke. The most unwoke show you've ever... Like, what are they going to be saying the N-word? Like, what is going... Like, what is this show going to be? What do you guys think woke is?
That sounds a lot like Last Man Standing, which, yeah, Tim Allen has been working on for the last... Or was working on for about a decade, so... He's already tried that, and I guess it was popular. But it's just really, really unfortunate and painful to watch.
And the comics, like Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel, throughout the whole Trump administration, they suffered a lot of consequences for speaking that truth to power. I mean, Trump sent the FCC against Stephen Colbert. Mm-hmm. Like, there were a lot of...
And you better believe that if Trump wins, we are going to lose so much comedy.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, it's going to be bad. I'm a lot more confident in how the election's going to go now. But if Trump wins somehow, yeah, we're kind of fucked as far as a lot of things go. But comedy is going to be something that is fucked up.
Yeah, because you can't really have a comedy.
Honestly, on that front, I'm feeling pretty enthusiastic. Largely just because of how Kamala Harris has been, like, responding in her more recent rallies.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly
Absolutely.
When there was a group protesting her, I believe, in Arizona. She paused the rally and took a moment to, like, address the protesters directly, say, hey, I think I know, like, what's going on here, like, basically called for a ceasefire in Gaza, and the sentence she said, like, after, like, immediately after is that me and the president are working around the clock to make sure that happens. Like, honestly, I am, and the crowd just roared. Mm-hmm. And, like, even then, in a different rally, one of the crowds started shouting, like, he won't win. And then Harris changes it, and she just says, we will win, and the crowd changes with her.
Yeah, absolutely. Same here.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think comedy was one of the ways that we, in some ways, have survived the last 8 years. And now with this new campaign where we're seeing candidates that are joyful, that are authentic, that are funny, and not in, like, the cringy kind of, like, oh, God, this is so absurd, I can't even help but laugh. But there's almost just this, like, collective sigh of relief that this is something we can all put ourselves behind again and not just, like, just go through the motions so we can keep our democracy. And I think that is getting back to the whole reason we don't have funny late night hosts that are on the conservative side is because you can't really have comedy in an authoritarian government, because comedy is honest. The best comics, again, you know, they're speaking truth to power. They're saying the quiet part out loud. They're not taking themselves so seriously and basically forcing the political oppressors to have some humility and hubris. And the side that wants to basically institute authoritarian government, you can't have comics. You can't have people making fun of the dictator. That doesn't happen in these authoritarian dictatorships. And so in some ways, comedy is like revolution. Comedy is one of the things that you know you have a free and a society where people can have the right to speak their mind and speak things that maybe those in power are at times making fun of them. And
So in some ways, comedy is indicative of a democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. What do you see on the comedy landscape with social media and new technologies? I found that I am watching way more stand-up now than I ever have in my life. And I've always liked stand-up, but right now there's so much of it that's geared mm-hmm. toward like little sound bites that are really easy for people to share online. Yeah, do you feel like that format is a real change for comedy, or yeah, what's your
take? I just joined TikTok, but I haven't really noticed any. I haven't been getting any like stand up on my feed. I did get something from, I forget what his name is, but he's young on the Daily Show now. Josh Jackson, I want to say. I saw like this long clip of his, but aside from that, I have not seen any stand up. However, the reason why I did join TikTok was because I wanted to just post little clips of my stand-up
right,
on there.
Right. How has that gone for you?
You know, it's funny. When I first started, I was getting like 800, 700 views on my posts and getting like around 70 likes. And then I posted this one joke about Eric Trump where I said, no one in the history of the world has ever wanted to suck their father's dick more than Eric Trump. And after I posted that, my stuff has been getting a lot less views and a lot less likes. And I'm like, that's weird, right? Someone who is controlling TikTok did not like my political takes.
Well, I tell you what, Facebook loves the political takes of Matt Rife. I have never seen so much of one comedian that I can't stand in my life as seeing little clips.
I have no idea who that is.
He's definitely like Facebook famous and social media famous, but that's about it. And he basically just has this really, he's been described before as like, he looks almost exactly like Chucky's mom from Rugrats, the Rugrats cartoon. And he makes he does a lot of like audience work where people now show up to his shows, I'm 100% convinced, just being like, I'm going to yell something weird and it's going to get me on YouTube and he's going to make a weird face. It's so bad. It's really bad. But it ends up popping up and I swipe on it just thinking, oh, a stand-up thing, and then it's him and I have to run away. So yeah, I'm seeing a lot of it on like basically Facebook Shorts is where it pops up. Although I have gotten off Facebook, so maybe I won't.
Yeah, I don't really use Facebook anymore. The only thing I use Facebook for is looking at my memories or using the chat. I don't use Facebook otherwise. Yeah. I use Twitter a lot.
You mean X?
No, I mean Twitter. I'm not going to acknowledge it as X. Fuck Elon Musk. He kind of ruined Twitter. I went off Twitter for a long time after he bought it because it was just a barrage of misinformation and racists running rampant. So I went off for a while and it was kind of like, I just love making dumb jokes on Twitter. So yeah, I eventually had to go back on there and just read a lot less of the content in order to keep my sanity.
Yeah, reading less content for our sanity is a great idea, I think.
Yeah. And now I'm on TikTok and it's just, you can't even like choose what pops up on your feed. It's just so much pro-Trump stuff. And I know this is not real people. There are like sometimes where I'll see a video and it'll be like someone talking right to the camera and I'm looking at it, kind of squinting my eyes, and I'm thinking, this isn't a real person. This is AI. This is not a real person with real thoughts. This is AI telling me some propaganda. And that's really scary. AI is very scary sometimes.
Do you talk about AI at all in any of your comedy?
I have not. Not yet, anyways.
Have you used AI to write any of your comedy?
Absolutely not. I won't even, like, if I'm talking to Bruisha about, like, stuff I want to write, if they start pitching me jokes, I won't use it because I want to write everything that I say. However, screenwriting is different. I will take other people's ideas and make them my own.
Yeah.
But I feel like stand-up is different. I'm sure some people would disagree with me, but yeah. Because some comics do have other people write their material.
Yeah, it just feels like that's not right on some fundamental level, although I'm not prepared to make, like, a full ethical treatise on it.
That's how I feel. I mean, there are some times where we're talking about something and you're like, you keep, like, pitching jokes and I'm like, stop talking! You're gonna come up with something really funny that I want to say and I can't say it now because it's your joke.
Oh my gosh, that's also what it's like being in academia. It's like, oh look, this person just published the same paper that I almost submitted that I've been working on for 5 years. Okay, how else can I frame this analysis? What other variable might be interesting?
Are you worried about AI taking jobs from writers and comedy writers?
Well, right now, the Screenwriters Guild, they have a pretty good contract where they can't be fucked over by AI. But AI is scary. It seems like it's going to take over. Like, eventually it could take over screenwriting. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you could enjoy a movie if you knew that it was written by AI? Or would that just ruin it for you?
It depends on how good the movie was. I will say this, though. I don't think AI couldn't create a new Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson is something on his own. AI could not create a brand new director that is his own thing.
Or her own thing.
Their own thing. I apologize. That was very stupid to say.
But yeah,
AI could not create a brand new auteur.
You know, I do write quite a bit of music using sampled material. And I do kind of make it into my own. But, like, to a degree, that has a lot of the same ethical questions that is presented with AI. And I guess the closest I've had to an answer with the question that we've kind of been circling around of, like, yeah, is this going to take people's jobs? Is this going to basically destroy everything we know and love? The closest I have to an answer to that is AI, like any gun, is a tool.
Yeah.
Can be used as...
I will say I was really impressed with the George Carlin special that was supposedly written by AI. Although the creators are now saying that it was not AI, that they wrote it themselves. But it's all tied up in a lawsuit. And I think they're seeing...
What was this?
This group, Dudezy, put out an hour 15, hour and a half long set by... Well, it was by George Carlin, who...
It was supposed to be George
dead.
Carlin.
But it was... It mimicked his voice and, like, in every way. And it was this full special. And it was kind of funny and interesting and weird to listen to, and a lot of the set was bits about being an AI, and about it was very self-referential, but also being George Carlin. But now they've called that into question and saying that no, a human was actually involved in the writing of the jokes. So, yeah, I mean, it's just like a whole other level of not knowing what's real and what's not. Right. I think that's one of the perennial topics that I come back to on this show around AI is, like, we just don't know at this point where words are coming from.
Yeah, we're living in the age of misinformation. but I'll take liberal funny misinformation over deranged MAGA misinformation any day of the week.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a range of scary.
We all know that J.D. Vance did not actually, like, physically, like, really fuck a couch. I mean, maybe he did, but it's just silly. It's just funny to say that, and yeah, that misinformation is fine.
Versus Lady Gaga is drinking the blood of children in a Pizza Hut basement, or yeah, they're definitely on a different level.
Yeah, because that's going to, people who believe that, that's going to piss them off. Anyone who believes J.D. Vance fucked the couch is not going to be like, he did what? What? They're just going to laugh.
Again, there's that speaking that truth to power. You know, somehow, even though apparently it was just, quote, fake news that he did fuck a couch, the fact that it's now become one of the things that history will remember him for. And also it's like,
it's definitely going to be a footnote in the in the history books.
It's causing these authoritarian figures to have a little bit more humility and almost like making fun of them in ways that they can't really counter.
Well, I think the Republicans started something about Kamala's VP.
Oh, Tim Walz.
Tim Walz, yeah. They started something about him with, like, him drinking, like, semen or something. And it's just so over the top that no one's gonna... No, that's... It's not believable. J.D. Vance might have actually fucked a couch.
And okay, yeah, like... If the New York Times is gonna report that J.D. Vance did not, in fact, fuck a couch, I'm sorry, I do not believe that. Like, the title of the article just, that's just, like, saying, okay, who was saying that you did?
Like, it was a post that went around on Twitter that had an excerpt from his first edition of the Hillbilly Elegy. Yes, and it wasn't real, but it looked real, and it was real enough to get...
And it sounds believable. It does.
Well, this brings up one of the questions that kind of rounding out this interview is, like, what do you think the future of comedy is?
The future of comedy? Comedy is always changing. And it's interesting that you'll see something, like, we were just watching Step Brothers not that long ago, and you'd never seen it, and it's one of my all-time favorite comedies, and I think it's 2008 movie, and when we were watching it, like, a month or two ago, not all of it aged well. I mean, it's still a very funny movie. I would still say it's one of my favorite comedies, but a lot of it... A good amount of it did not age well. And so it's hard to predict what comedy is going to be like. Because that was only, what, 16 years ago? 2008, 16 years ago? It's hard to say what's going to be funny in 30 years. And what is going on right now that will be seen as completely unacceptable, if anything. I mean, I'd like to think that the things I'm making jokes about now will still be funny in 30 years, but it's hard to know. Hopefully fucking Muppets will still be funny in 30 years.
Wasn't there something you said about, like, time plus...
Time plus tragedy equals comedy? Like, when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, it wasn't funny, but it can be plenty funny now. I've heard plenty of Lincoln assassination jokes that were pretty goddamn hilarious. But I'm sure back then it was not acceptable.
That American Dad episode with the play about Abraham Lincoln and his bodyguard.
Oh, yeah, I think I have seen this. Yeah, I think I've seen this. Yeah.
It's beautiful. Fantastic.
I'm gonna have so many show notes this time.
I should rewatch that one. I know I've seen it. And isn't it like Stan doesn't realize how gay it is until like it's like really in his face? He's the one who like wrote it, isn't he?
Yes.
In the episode?
And yes, and just so you know, that is exactly how I felt about being what it was like kind of being the egg trans experience. Is how many times it's been glaringly obvious, but just goes right the fuck over my head. That episode is a great analogy for that.
Yeah, Inku and I were on a road trip through Kentucky, through some of the areas that Lincoln was like born and raised, and we kept looking for any sort of evidence that he was queer, because he had a boyfriend through the entire time he was president.
Mm-hmm.
There was a who was it, Inku? You know this story a little bit better than me.
It's been a minute since I thought about it. He had a very close friend from college up through his presidency. And no one really knows what the, you know, there was definitely a really intense friendship. And
they
it's possible. It's definitely within the realm of possibility. But
they fucked a lot.
They did go, when they stayed in hotel rooms together, they got a room with a single bed. That's what we have records of. It wasn't totally unheard of for men to sleep in the same bed at the time, but when you're the president of the United States, you could probably get an extra room or an extra bed. It usually happened out of financial necessity. But we can't say that he was gay or not. I mean, we can say that the category gay didn't exist at the time in the way that it does now. But we can say it also was, you know, knew his friend very well.
I mean, he was probably just bi. I don't think he was...
Well, that's also a category that didn't even exist at the time. And a lot of, you know, in that era, you know, sexuality was more like a really preference over identity. So, like, you know, today we have some people who like sweet tea or like unsweet tea. It's not like you're a sweet tea person or actually, I guess that's a bad example because that's definitely how it's framed here in the deep south. So, but it was seen as like, oh, of course, it's just expected that if you're a male and you're middle class, you're going to get married and you're going to have children because that's your social responsibility. But otherwise, men's sexuality wasn't really policed that much if they had other partners being of any gender. There was actually, in some ways, a lot more sexual freedom at the time for men, very specifically. But there was no identity connected to it, and you definitely would keep it usually quiet, although I feel like the hotel thing is a pretty big tell. I don't think we have letters from Lincoln to his special friend like we do for so many women of the time who, you know, were often writing about wanting to fall into each other's lips like a dew of honey and things like that. They were roommates, as the meme would go. But and the whole idea of, there was the whole idea at the time as well of like a Boston marriage, which is two quote unquote spinsters moving in together as friends. But like, in retrospect, you know, they all looked exactly like that evil woman from The Wizard of Oz, who was definitely a lesbian. So, they were probably mainly lesbians.
I guess a good last question is, how do you deal with hecklers?
I have not really had to deal with hecklers yet, and I don't know how I will deal with it. I actually just did a show that was called Chaos, where there was 15 comics, and no one knew what was going to happen other than something crazy was going to happen during your set. And during my set, there was someone playing a French horn behind me the whole time, and I was trying to ignore it, but it was there, and I interacted with the person very briefly. But I think that was an interesting, I feel like that was at least somewhat helpful for when I have to deal with a heckler. I'm normally not even very good at crowd work. I'm trying to get better at that. I was going to say, really the only way that I interact with the audience is if a joke bombs, and I want to, like, I just want to acknowledge either that they should have laughed or I understand why they didn't. That's been my extent of crowd work so far.
I guess if I had to, like, give a piece of advice is hecklers are a part of the performance.
That's true.
Depending on how you interact with them, that's gonna dictate, like, how the crowd will respond. If you're just, like, kind of letting the, like, things that the heckler is saying kind of get to you and just letting it kind of break the immersion.
I think when I have to deal with a heckler, it'll really depend on what I'm being heckled by. Like, if it's a Trump joke,
yeah,
and the heckler is a Trump supporter, I might have to lay into them a bit. But if I make a really dumb joke and someone in the audience is like, that was stupid, I might just have to agree with them. Be like, yes, you are correct. That was a really dumb joke. Here's the next one.
Correct. You are in a place where dumb jokes happen. Very observant.
No. This is a good one. So anything else you want to let our listeners know? Any projects or social media links that you
if anyone wants to check out my stand-up, I have a bunch of stuff on Instagram and TikTok under @NotSoEvilRick. So if anyone's interested, I have a bunch of shit on there.
Dating a stand-up comic is sort of one of those things where a lot of our conversations end up being in...
There was one time where we were at stand-up and one of the comics made a joke about how their significant other... Well, that's all they hear them talk about was stand-up. And you laughed so hard at that. And I was like, fuck, is that all I talk about now? Do I just talk about stand-up? I'm sorry.
No, but I'm really supportive of your stand-up career. And you make me laugh. I mean, that's how I fell in love with you, is I saw you up there on that stage and you made me laugh harder than any of the other comics. And I was like, oh, I have to go tell him how amazing I thought his comedy was. And, you know, and 5 months later, we pretty much have almost just been inseparable. But yeah, like, it becomes such a big part of our relationship, because you're always making these comments about things, and the way you just think about things and the way you observe the world is just so funny to me that I don't mind that a lot of it ends up being in your stand-up. Like, you have a really funny jokes about how your non-binary girlfriend is never more your boyfriend than when I do these things that make you really...
When you're blowing your nose in the shower?
And I'm never more your boyfriend when I finish... a drink in a can, I throw it behind me.
Oh no, you wrote that one. I'm not using that.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of our sex life ends up being in the stand-up. And it's also really, it means a lot to me that you get my consent before you go up there and you make jokes about our sex life. Because I've seen some comics go up there and talk about their sex life in ways that, like, is mean. Like,
it's like, you guys need to have better sex. The sex you're having is not good. Have better sex.
Or one comic was talking about how he fucking fat girls, and his partner was in the audience.
No, I don't think she was there that night. We saw her there another night. I don't think he would do that material if she was there.
That's so mean. I don't like that.
Yeah, there's some...
So yeah, I mean, it's...
Oh, that just... It got ickier over time, that story.
Yeah. So Rick always gets my consent anytime he uses our sex life in his stand-up routine, and I really appreciate that, because I'm basically consenting to be in the jokes. But I think that in some ways it shows the other comics that...
It's also funny that, like... any time any of the other comics are, like, talking about sex, it's always something miserable. And then I'll go up on there and I'll be, like, so positive about, like, the sex that I'm having. And I'm sure a lot of these people are like, fuck you, dude.
But also, you know, it's not mean.
No. You know? It's all positive.
And that's, you know, something I really appreciate. All right, well, we'll wrap this up. Thank you so much, Mio, for coming on the podcast.
No problem. It was fun.
Yeah, and I'll make sure to put the show notes up for our folks out there listening so that they can connect and see your dumb jokes on TikTok and Twitter and
emphasis
Instagram.
On the dumb.
Before we go, can I do my obligatory AI exploration and share with y'all some
yes.
AI jokes? All right.
Sure.
All right. So
absolutely.
I was hanging out, I was canoeing with my friend and her daughter the other day. Her daughter's really into jokes, and they're all, you know, she's 11. So they're all, yeah, I try to make myself laugh sometimes. But then she kept asking me to tell her jokes, and I'm really bad at thinking of jokes off the top of my head. So I did ask ChatGPT one, and now you all get to hear it. What do clouds wear under their clothes?
What?
Thunderwear! Which was especially fun because we were out on a kayak on a lake with a lot of thunder around us. It's almost like it picked up that context clue. And one more for the yoga fans. I did ask it for a knock-knock joke based on yoga, a yoga-themed knock-knock joke. So, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Y'all are good at this. Namaste.
Namaste who?
Namaste in bed. Or should we go to yoga? There we go. So, I do, you know, I often sing the praises of ChatGPT and these AI models, and they can be really helpful sometimes. But I don't think they're writing jokes. I don't think they have jokes to write that comics should be worried about. So maybe comedy will be the last refuge of intellectual work when AI takes everything else over.
Yeah. Perhaps.
AI is funny in the same way that Hillary Clinton is funny.
Oh, yeah, she has problems.
All right. On that note... Let's go ahead and close the recording.
Thank you so much to Rick for coming on to the podcast, and please be sure to check him out on Instagram and TikTok for more of his comedy stylings. And if you are local to the Salem and Portland area, come check him out at the Infinity Room, open mic on Wednesday nights in downtown Salem.
And speaking of the Infinity Room, we have finally wrapped up this year's Trans Telethon, and we raised over $200, which went directly to Rainbow Railroad, and we had a brilliant performance by all of our performers, but especially, I think, by our co-host, Ruby. She played her cello and sang, and it was really amazing to get to host such a wonderful performance. We already have ideas and what we want to do next year to even make a bigger production next time, but if you missed the show and you want to check it out, we now have it up on our YouTube channel.
If you like what we're doing here on the podcast and you want to support us and our work, the best way to do that is via Patreon. At just our $1 a month level, you can get access to our bonus content, including a new episode of Who's in Bloom on Cyclamen. Angel is posting exclusively on Patreon, as well as a new series they are calling Tripping Through the Tarot, with the first episode on The Fool. They also post various eclectic offerings, including their yoga practice recordings and recipes.
At our $5 a month level, we are reformatting the way we do our Deity Deep Dive series and sticker exchange, where each season we will feature an episode and corresponding sticker for a chosen deity. For this upcoming season of autumn, we are featuring Athena, goddess of wisdom and strategy and justice, with artwork by Angel and music for the Deity Deep Dive by myself. If you join at this level, each quarter you will receive a sticker of the deity in the mail, So if you like getting mail, this is the level for you.
Finally, at the $10 a month level, our Science Witch Coven, you will have access to my tarot practice that I'm offering readings over Zoom. My life has been a chaotic mess these past few months, but I'm finally able to start booking tarot clients again. So send me a message via Patreon to book your 30-minute tarot reading over Zoom for members of this level.
And of course, listening and sharing the podcast with your friends is also invaluable to our success. We are slowly reaching our goal towards getting 1,000 Spotify listeners, so we can start to monetize the podcast a bit more and also make joining our Patreon for ad-free episodes even more attractive. If you're looking for community, be sure to check out our Discord server and join in on the discussions of the occult, plant magic, and science, and all sorts of fun memes we've been sharing about the election.
And finally, if you'd like to find us on social media, look for us at Science Witch Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Thread, and Science Witch Podcast on the platform formerly known as Twitter. Show notes and transcripts are available on our website at sciencewitchpodcast.com. And if you'd like to just email us, you can do so at questions@sciencewitchpodcast.com. And until next time,
live long and prosper,
and blessed be.